Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 7th, 2007, and this is show number 77. Whew, that's a lot of sevens. At least they're not sixes. Anyway, happy New Year officially now. My last podcast was delivered before the end of the year, but you probably heard it in 2007. I'm pleased to announce that I finally got my new theme up and working on podfeet.com. I worked on it on and off over a two-week vacation, but of course in the end it took Bart's help to make it actually work. He fixed it in about 15 minutes, and I've been beating my head against it for 2 weeks. Of course, the fact that I don't know any PHP, Perl, or CSS might have had something to do with that. I did buy a CSS book and made it about halfway through before I got bored, and I got a WordPress book from my friend Nancy that helped me out a lot, but the subtleties are way beyond me, that's for sure. What I'm most excited about is that I finally have the fabulous logo designed by listener Ryan from Hawaii up as the banner on the top of the website. It's so dramatic and gives a much more technical feel to the site than the girly one I had for so long. Heck, it even says it's a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Ryan has even designed new business cards for me with an adaptation of the artwork, and they're just spectacular. Can't wait to get those printed. I'll put a copy of how they look in the show notes so you can see how creative he is. You really should check out his site where he shows off his artwork at graphicforce.net. I gotta tell you, I'm amazed continuously at the generosity of people with their time and talents, and I really appreciate that. Makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Now, what you might have noticed is that my website has been randomly switching back to the default WordPress theme. I have this great banner thing saying, "Yay, the new theme!" And then I go look at it, and it's this plain old blue blog-looking thing. I have no idea what's been causing it, but a search on the WordPress forums revealed several people with the same issue. There was some discussion that maybe there was a plugin that was the culprit, but no conclusions or even accusations of which plugin were made. One person said that they fixed it by changing the name of their theme folder to default, so I decided to give that a try. I did try just deleting the default theme, but ooh, that was a huge mistake. Because it turned out my site still tried to switch over to the default theme, and when it couldn't find it, it just came up blank. Oh, man. I found out that on the forums, one person solved it by doing that change to the default, so that's what I've set up now, and for over 24 hours, it's actually stayed with the real site, so I sure hope the theme looks good to you. Hey, I tell you what, if you notice it doing anything funny, please put a comment in the show notes or drop me an email, okay? Sure would like a heads up. Listener Steve sent in an audio comment that I think you might find interesting. Let's give a listen.
Hello, Allison. This is listener Steve. I've been a listener since day one, and I love the NoSillaCast. You have a great show with interesting content. I particularly like how you begin a segment with, "What problem does this application or tool solve?" Your show is very informative and keeps me awake. That's why I was quite surprised to hear something unusual on show number 76. Even though you attempted to mask it, I believe I heard you yawn three times in the middle of your podcast, while you were talking. Now, I've experienced several instances where a podcaster has put their audience to sleep, but this has got to be a first. A podcaster actually putting themselves to sleep. Must be all the time you're putting into the show and not getting sleep. Well, I hope you've caught a few more winks since show number 76. And in any case, still love the NoSillaCast. I'll be sure to stay subscribed.
Well, thanks for your nice comments, Steve. I sure am glad you like the show. And I do have to confess that you were right. I did yawn several times during the recording last week. The really sad part is that I actually edited out the worst yawn. I think it lasted like 5 seconds. I thought I could get away with the little ones and maybe nobody would notice. I guess my only excuse is that it was New Year's Day, and even though my husband let me sleep in that one day and not get up at the crack of doom and go work out, I was still really sleepy by the time I started recording. Sure hope I didn't put any of you to sleep. I'll try to stay awake from now on. Thanks for your nice comments, Steve. I appreciate it. 2 weeks ago, I did a review of a product called ImageCaster, which is a Mac application that allows you to create a webcam. I loved the software, but I did have one complaint, and that was that even though I had a legitimate license, it kept saying that it was for evaluation only. I was able to make contact with the developer, Joe, and he explained that the evaluation box only comes up for press versions of the software, so no one else would see that box. Well, I gotta tell you, that's good to know. So that means I give ImageCaster from econtechnologies.com a 100% approval rating. Worked perfectly. Well, while Bart was helping me again in my nearly futile attempts to design a new theme for podfeet.com, he turned me on to a really cool plugin for Firefox. The chances are that you'll actually need this are pretty slim, but it turned out to be pretty useful to me. So you remember the problem I'm trying to solve here is that I got really close to getting the header image into WordPress that I wanted, but it wasn't aligned properly with the graphics of the theme I had chosen. Like I said, I worked on it for a couple of weeks before I had Bart help me. So all of the theme files are in there, and you're trying to figure out which of the theme files are driving which part of the display. And wouldn't it be cool if you had a tool that could allow you to hover over a website and it'd tell you what code was driving how that piece of it worked? Well, that's exactly the problem Aardvark solves, which is downloadable from the Firefox add-on site, addons.mozilla.org/Firefox, or the easiest way is if you're running Firefox, you can simply pull down on the menu called Tools and go down to Add-ons. That opens a window that shows the add-ons you already have installed, and at the bottom it says Get Extensions. If you click on that, it takes you to the add-on site where you can search for Aardvark. Just as a quick aside, the one problem I have with Firefox is that they call the same function three different things. They call them extensions, they call them add-ons, they're plugins. I never know which one they're talking about, but it's all the same thing. Kind of confusing. Anyway, once you install Aardvark, which by the way is spelled A-A-R-D-V-A-R-K, you're told that you need to restart Firefox, which used to irritate me because I'd lose all the tabs I had open. But the latest version of Firefox 2.0 allows you to reopen it with all the tabs just the way you left them. When you first open Firefox, you won't notice anything different from your Aardvark installation. But if you get to a site you want to analyze, heck, do it on Google, it's kind of fun, you pull down on the Tools menu again, and now there's an option at the bottom that says Start Aardvark. Once you start it, simply hover your mouse around the screen, and you'll see a dark blue border jump up around the element you're looking at, and there will be a couple of little tags showing, like the div class and the header class. I don't actually necessarily know exactly what that means, but it did give me a few clues to where WordPress was looking to build up the pages for me. One thing that was a big relief to me was that Aardvark has to be started for every page you want to analyze. I was kind of worried it would be one of those things that's on all the time and it'd get really irritating because it'd be flinging stuff all over and I'd have to just delete it soon enough. Even if you don't need to use Aardvark, it's pretty interesting to see what it can do, so you might want to go check it out. Ages ago, I podcasted about a great feature in Google where it'll do unit conversions for you. For example, you could write in the search term 5 gallons in liters, and Google simply returns the correct number of liters. It's a great feature and was really, really handy. So on New Year's Day, Bart and I were chatting, and I wanted to make him jealous of the weather out in sunny Southern California, so I told him it was 72 degrees out. He, of course, replied with, "What's that in real degrees?" Nonplussed, I headed on over to Google and typed in 72 degrees F in C. It didn't give me the answer. Just gave me a bunch of search results. I tried 72 degrees Fahrenheit in centigrade, and that didn't work either. What the heck? How will Bart and I communicate across the pond? Will this mean the breakdown of all transatlantic communications? Well, I headed on over to a really cool site called Google Guide, where they teach how to do things like this. The site is googleguide.com/calculator.html. About halfway down, they show a few examples, such as one that says 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit in degrees Celsius. The examples are there as links, so I clicked on that one, and it didn't work. Can't believe this is broken. And how do you tell Google that it's broken? I read around on this particular website and discovered that this is not an official Google site, but the developer's address was there, so I dropped her a note to see if she knows what's going on. While we're at it, let me do a quick review of Google Guide, again at googleguide.com. Nancy Blachman, B-L-A-C-H-M-A-N, is the developer, and she's put together an online interactive tutorial and reference for experienced users, novices, and anyone in between. She has a button for novices and one for experienced users. I figured I could qualify for the latter due to my extensive research over the past weeks into the Google tools. We're almost halfway through, by the way. I went through a few of the tutorials, and it's very well laid out. She shows you a couple of features, then explains how she uses them. Get it? What problem do they solve? And that really helps me get excited about a tool or capability, so I liked it a lot. I learned some things right away that I didn't know. Well, while I was fooling around with that, Nancy Blachman wrote back with my question about Google's temperature calculations and other unit conversions. She wrote back almost immediately. The interesting thing was that by the time I got her email, Google was fixed for unit conversions. Whew, thank goodness our transatlantic conversations are protected. One thing is still a little bit odd. You're supposed to be able to type in a word in the blue bar, and you know, there's a kind of blue bar across the top. Well, there should be a link to definition. You should see the word definition there, and you can click on it. So you type in some word, click on definition, and you'd be able to see the definition of the word. But it stopped working. That's not working that way right now either. If you type definition before the word in the search term, then the definition link does show up. So you write definition space aardvark, and then you have to click on the definition button. Might just be a change to the way it's meant to work. I'm not sure, but I wrote back to Nancy about it just in case. Anyway, the thing I got out of it was that I found Google Guides, so when I want to learn even more about Google, I'm going to go to googleguides.com. Well, I'm proud to announce that I have my very first corporate sponsor. One thing that bothers me about getting sponsors is that I just can't stand the idea of endorsing something in which I don't believe. It seems so dirty to me to pretend that you think something's cool if you really don't. I mean, it just doesn't sit right with me. Well, luckily, my first sponsor is HDA Bob's Mobile Service. You've heard me talk about HDA Bob a bunch of times. He's been my mechanic for 28 years, and he has a terrific service model. Get this, he drives to your house to work on your car. I don't have to go down to a dealer and sit with a grate unwashed waiting for my car to get ready or be driven back to work by some creepy guy. I just wait at my house and Bob comes and visits me. Not only is he taking care of my cars for all these years, he's also become a close friend, and to my great pleasure, I've discovered that he's a geek as well. He loves to teach as well, so he's created his own website. Yes, mechanic by day, webmaster by night. Even if you don't live in the Los Angeles area where Bob could come fix your car, you'd really learn a lot if you check out his website. He's at hdabob.com, and he's done a great job. For example, if you click on the Start button on his homepage, you're taken to the main focal area for how he teaches. He put in a picture of a red Honda Element, that's his current car, and if you hover over an area on the car, you can get to links about how each part of the car works. For example, hover over the brakes, and you're taken to his instructions on how anti-lock brakes work. I'll tell you more about HDA Bob's site over the coming weeks, but go check it out. You might learn something. In last week's podcast, I talked about how I was trying to widen the screen width of the site, which, by the way, I never did achieve. And in talking about that, I said I figured that nobody used screen resolutions below 1024 by 768 these days, but all blogs are still set up to support 800 by 600 resolution. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, computer monitors are made up of dots, and the number of dots across by the number of dots up and down is called the screen resolution. The bigger the number of dots, the more sharp the images on screen will look. If you have a bigger monitor, it can also have more dots as a result, too. Anyway, a while ago I turned on Google Analytics, which allows me to track all kinds of interesting statistics about my website, but I'd never actually looked at it till this week. Imagine my surprise when I discovered that one of the statistics it collects is the resolution of the screens which have used my sight. I thought that was pretty interesting that they can do that. I do not understand how they can do that. But imagine my further surprise when I found out that about 3% of the visitors to the podfeet.com website are using 800 by 600 resolution. The good news for those of you out there is that I'm not a good enough programmer yet to make the site unusable for you for now, but I don't promise anything for the future. I'm still going to try to get it wider. In case you're curious, the most common resolution is 1024 by 768 with 29% of the viewers, followed closely by 1280 by 1024, which is another 20% of the users. We must also have a bunch of MacBook Pro readers because coming in third is 1440 by 900, which happens to be the resolution of the MacBook Pros. There's probably other laptops out there with the same resolution, but that's the only one I know of for sure. I am going to keep trying to widen the theme because since I was successful on my old theme in getting it wider, with Tim Rossi's help, I went back and looked at some of my old posts, and it turns out the images are all squished up. They look real funny, so I kind of have to figure this out eventually. I'm going to start working on it again. Well, we had fun a while ago playing with fun numbers, and Bart turned me on to another cool number-based thing. This isn't any new Web 2.0 JavaScript thing. It's actually an invention from 1617 called Napier's Bones. I don't know why, but this just really, really fascinated me, so you get to hear about it. Napier's Bones were invented by John Napier to make it possible to do complex multiplication problems using only addition and division using only subtraction. Napier's Bones are strips of wood that have one number at the top and a series of numbers down the length of it. The numbers down the length are in pairs separated by a diagonal line. This is easiest to explain using an example. Let's say the bone we're looking at is the number 7 bone. So there's a 7 at the top. The 7 at the top represents 7 times 1. The next pair of numbers below it represents 7 times 2. So it's a 1 and a 4, again separated by that diagonal line. This pair is followed by a 2 and a 1, representing 7 by times 3, and this goes on until the last pair is 7 times 9, or a 6 and a 3, 63. Now that we have one bone created, we can imagine how the other bones look. Remember that each pair of numbers is separated by a diagonal line, because that's going to be really important when we actually start getting into how it works. The bones are placed onto a board, which has a 1 through 9 in a column down the left-hand side. Are you with me so far? Don't worry, when I'm all done, I'll give you a link so you can go see what it looks like. Okay, so we've got this built-in column of numbers down the left-hand side, 1 through 9. Let's say we want to multiply 7 times 5,364. Well, we go get the bones for 5, 3, 6, and 4, and lay them down on the board in that order. Since we want to multiply the big number times 7, we go down the left-hand column to the 7, and then we read across the four bones. What we can see if we focus on just the sevens row is the second number in each pair lines up diagonally with the first number in the pair to the left of it. You really have to press your mind to visualize this, I'm sure, but when you see it with the diagonal lines, it's really obvious that each pair of numbers goes together. So now all we have to do to get the answer is to add the diagonal pairs we just identified, starting from the right side and working across, and using carryovers if necessary. I know this sounds like a whole bunch of work, but it's really quite easy since the bones are right there in front of you. Of course, I actually have a debilitating impairment that makes this really hard for me. You see, you may think that I'm a brilliant scientist and engineer that I make myself out to be, but secretly it turns out I can't add or subtract in my head. I took 2 years of calculus in college, passed with flying colors. And yet the idea of doing subtraction if there's an 8 involved gives me a cold chill. My dad even got me flashcards when I was in college and tried to teach me how to do addition and subtraction in my head, but it was too late. I actually blame the whole thing on what they did in the U.S. when I was a little kid was called new math. instead of teaching you to just memorize addition, like 8 plus 3 is, wait, let me check, 11. Instead of doing that, they said, well, take the 3 and break it up into a 2 and a 1. So you add the 2 to the 8, and that gives you 10 plus 1 is 11. Imagine how long it takes me to do math if every number I'm going, 8 plus 3 is 8 plus 2 plus 1. That's 8 plus 2 is 10 plus 1 is 11. When the rest of you just went, 8 plus 3 is 11. So it's basically like when I'm trying to do arithmetic, it's like I'm reading phonetically every single time over and over again. It was the cruelest thing they did to me. So anyway, here I am doing the Napier's Bones because I wanted to do this example. And I made so many addition mistakes, both with the bones and then when I tried to check my work with real multiplication, that I actually had to drag out a calculator to fix my problem. How sad is that? Anyway, I'm glad to say that the Napier's Bones were right, and I got the answer of 37,548. Well, you might ask what would happen if it's a more complex number than 7 for the first operator. It turns out you just keep repeating the process I described for each digit, and then add all of the numbers together. Of course, as in normal multiplication style, you have to shift the answers to the left one digit at a time. Can you imagine adding all those numbers together, though? Whew! I shudder at the thought. As entertaining as it would be for me to describe how to do division with Napier's Bones, that's got subtraction in it, which is even more frightening for me. So I think I'll leave that to the listener. Head on over to the link I put in the show notes for Wikipedia and type in Napier's Bones. That's NAPIER'S. Or go to the show notes, like I said, and just click the link. I hope you'll find this as interesting as I did. I really had fun learning about this. I have half a mind to make myself one. If my dad were still alive, I bet he would make me one. Well, I'm sure you're all getting sick and tired of hearing me talk about St. Bart, but I really want to tell you about his blog and his podcast. Bart's blog at bartbouchatz.ie/blog. And by the way, Bart Bouchatz is not possible for normal humans to spell, so go look at the link in the show notes, or you can see it in the blog rollover on podfeet.com. Bart's blog is an interesting conglomeration of technical information. For example, the last 4 posts were about Macworld, running Nmap on Intel Macs, simple Java configuration files, and the upcoming Harry Potter book. His writing style is easy to read, and if you stick to the topics that are within your realm of understanding, you'll learn a lot from him. He's a Mac and Linux bigot, so keep that in mind. My kind of guy. Now, if you're interested in astronomy, you're going to love Bart's IFAS website and podcast. IFAS stands for Irish Federation of Astronomical Societies, and it's at irishastronomy.org. I'm not an astronomy buff myself, but if you are, the wealth of information on this site is phenomenal, and it's beautiful, too. I love his theme. It's so pleasing and yet dramatic at the same time. He's got a link on his site where you can subscribe to his podcast, which tells you all about the upcoming astronomical events, and also to his podcast website with his great show notes, too. Check out both of these if you've got any interest in astronomy, and you'll have a great time. Well, it's time for another installment of our review of all Google products. Would you believe we're on part 6? And like I said, we're almost halfway done. The next tool in Google's arsenal is Google Scholar at scholar.google.com. When you first go to Google Scholar, it's not obvious what it's all about. It just looks like regular Google pretty much, except it says, "Stand on the shoulders of giants" below it. Great line. And, of course, it's beta. I clicked on About Google Scholar to see what it was all about. In there, it says, Google Scholar provides a simple way to broadly search for scholarly literature. In here, you can search across peer-reviewed papers, theses, books, abstracts, and articles. The sources are academic publishers, professional societies, preprint repositories, universities, and other scholarly organizations. I think this could be important to use in areas of science, to be able to search on something like string theory, whether you believe in it or not, through true scholarly sources is pretty cool. One good question answered here is, how are these sources ranked? Could the page link algorithm of Google itself work here? It turns out that Google weighs articles on how often the piece has been cited in other scholarly literature. So it goes straight from scholarly literature, which is good. I sure hope they have a way of making sure that it's referred to in tons of articles, but not about how it's wrong. I mean, what if like everybody was talking about how this one guy was really stupid and he did it wrong? Would that get the highest hits? That wouldn't be good. Google Scholar invites publishers to include their publications in Google Scholar, and they also have two solutions to help librarians enhance their patrons' experience at their library. I haven't thought of an immediate use for Google Scholar, but I'll keep it in the back of my mind, probably checking it out the next time I have to prove a point for a bet or something. Next up is Google Specialized Searches. Remember how we went through the Google Max searches way back on number 74 on December 17th? I'm sure you had the show number memorized, by the way. Anyway, Google Specialized Searches is where google.com/Mac is showcased. But it turns out there's four other specialized searches as well. First, there's U.S. government. It's actually sort of like google/IG, which is their customizable homepage we've talked about before. In fact, the site for the U.S. government is google.com/IG/USGov. It lets you customize the view of different topics. It comes pre-populated with weather, in Washington, D.C., of course, American Forces Information Services, White House News, Government Executive, whatever that is, top government stories, and Washington Post. You can add content to the site and move it around to customize it, but your choices are not more U.S. government content. It's content from a bunch of different categories like news, sports, technology, that sort of thing. You can even add in RSS feeds if you want. The next three types of specialized search are all operating systems like the Mac one. There's Linux, BSD, and Microsoft. Okay, so the purists will point out that Microsoft isn't an operating system, it's a company, so sue me. But that's what it says. Each of these works just like google.com/Mac, which is that they search only within the topic area. So if you want to know, say, how to boot into single user mode, and you choose google.com/Linux, you'll only get results from Linux-related sites. And of course, it has a nice penguin in the logo. Evidently, the BSD logo is a scary-looking little devil guy, because that's what google.com/BSD has wrapped around in the logo. google.com/microsoft.html is merely the standard Google logo on the XP grass and sky background. Not sure why they made the URL harder like that, adding the HTML to the end, unlike any of the rest of the specialized service searches. Oh well, it's always harder with Microsoft, I guess. Well, I mentioned last week that the company VMware has now come out with a product native to the Macintosh operating system. VMware is a company owned by EMC, the storage company, and they're pretty much the industry titan for running virtual machines. To review, a virtual machine is a whole separate operating system and file structure that lives as a guest on top of a host operating system. For example, you can have a Linux server that has several Windows virtual machines living on top of it. This allows you to create separate environments without paying for separate boxes. In the corporate world, this means huge savings in space, power, and air conditioning, while meeting users' needs for their own separate playground. You know how people don't want to share a server with others. If you have a virtual machine, the user can dictate how experimental they want to be without endangering the work of others on the same server. So, like, you don't all have to decide at the same time to upgrade to the next version of MySQL or something like that. Every group can do it on their own. What this means to us as consumers is that we can do things like run Windows on a Mac. So we have the best of both worlds. I've spent a lot of time talking about the virtues of Parallels, which was the first virtual machine program that ran on the Intel-based Macs. I guess you could count Virtual PC, because it was essentially a virtual machine, but since it was made back when Macs only ran on the power PCs, the performance was horrible. You see, it had to emulate the Intel hardware calls and translate them into the PowerPC calls, and that just made it just a real dog. Now that we have Intel Macs, we can have screaming fast performance in a virtual machine. This is what makes VMware a great solution for Linux and Windows as well. So, if we have parallels, why do we need VMware? Competition, that's why. The Parallels team will be very hard to catch up to, though, because if anything, they seem to be accelerating their development, and it was already really great. They keep coming out with enhancements that make it that much cooler. VMware is definitely coming from behind, but they have a lot of resources and have proven products, so they're likely to have a big impact in the corporate environment. Let's take a look at VMware and walk through how it's similar and different to Parallels. VMware is available from VMware.com, and the Mac download is currently on the front page. VMware for the Mac is called Fusion, and it's currently in beta. In the introduction, they say that Fusion will allow you to access USB 2.0 products like video cameras, iPods, printers, and disks at full speed, which, if true, is a step up from Parallels, as Parallels dials down all devices to USB 1.0 for some reason, and definitely does not support any video cameras that I've been able to find. Well, let's see if I can figure out how to get that part working. That would be fun. I downloaded Fusion, and it's about 110 meg, which isn't too bad considering what it does. Heck, that's smaller than the printer drivers for my darn HP all-in-one printer, but don't let me get started on that. Well, when you do the download, it gives you a serial number for the beta program, which you'll be asked to enter later, so it's a good idea to make a screen snapshot or print it to PDF for later reference. The beta build is 36932 right now. Once you've installed Fusion from the disk image, the usual double-clicking of the .pkg file, you start by selecting the operating system family and then the version within that family. So your choices of operating system family are Windows, Linux, Novell NetWare, or Solaris. The choices under Windows are too many to name, but let me tell you, they go from Windows 3.1 all the way up to Vista and 64-bit Windows, both of which say experimental next to them. It also includes server versions of many of the operating systems, such as 6 versions of Windows Server 2003. The choices under Linux are even more numerous. There's 8 versions of Red Hat, including 3 64-bit versions, 4 of SUSE, and then there's Mandrake and Ubuntu, and even some generic choices. One thing I should make sure you understand is these aren't operating systems that they are giving you. They're ones you can choose to install with your own versions of that software. So this is just that they've set up a lot of things around those operating systems to make them run well. They wouldn't all fit in 110 meg, obviously, if they were in there. So, once you choose what operating system you want to install, you tell Fusion whether you're going to install from a CD or use an ISO image that you've downloaded, which is the common way to do Linux installations. You have a third choice, which is Other, which is to install from a floppy or a network boot. The choices in this first step are definitely a lot more than there are in Parallels. Not sure I need all these choices, but the vast number of Linux choices leads me to believe that the one you choose could be run better than under Parallels because it's specifically tailored for that OS. When I did the Linux installation under Parallels, I had to pick the generic install, and things were pretty hinky. I did CentOS, and it wasn't in there. But, CentOS isn't in this one either. Yeah, well. I figured that I could enhance my entertainment level if I put a beta operating system on top of a beta virtual machine. So I chose Vista RC2 to put on top of Fusion Beta. I love it. That's like beta squared. Anyway, in the system settings, you're asked to give it a disk size, which is the maximum size it can grow to. As I explained in the installation of Parallels, it's a good idea to pick a big number here because you can't increase it later. I set most installs to use 12 gigabyte. Remember, the nice thing is it's not really going to take 12 gig. It can grow to 12 gig. In the meantime, it can stay small. Fusion also allows you to tell the virtual machine how many processors the VM is allowed to use. I chose 2 as I have 2 processors, and I want the best possible experience for my virtual machine. By the way, Parallels doesn't give you that as an option on the number of processors, so I think it uses as many as you have. Not really sure, though. Assigning memory is the next step, and this one's not that critical because it turns out you can choose how much to allocate each time you launch the virtual machine. The recommended value is 512 meg, but I gave Vista a full gigabyte, which may not even be enough. The next step is the long process of actually installing Windows, but luckily it doesn't take too much human interaction these days, just some patience. Let's fast forward past all that and look at it running. Wait, I was teasing. First, you need to know where Fusion puts the files, because you'll want to back these up to a DVD periodically so you can restore your entire installation easily if you get a virus or screw something up through excessive experimentation. Or maybe that's just me. Turns out Fusion keeps the files in a folder called VMware, stored at the top of your user directory. I think this is a bit presumptuous. I like to keep this directory relatively clean. I may move it later and see if it gets horked up. I did notice that Fusion puts a lot more files in there than Parallels. Parallels just has one big fat file and one little bitty file that goes with it. There were, I don't know, six or eight in the VMware folder. All right, let's run the VM already. When you first launch your guest OS from Fusion, you're faced with a window that warns that you're running in debug mode, which can't be disabled in the beta version. This mode enables extra logging so that they can help you if you have a problem. So you can probably send them debug logs and they can work on the code to figure out what went wrong. You can suppress this message if you like for later logins. Once Fusion launches, you have a bunch of buttons on top that I don't see in Parallels. There's shutdown, suspend, and startup, which are the same as Parallels, but you also have a settings button up there. Settings allows you to set up shared folders between the two operating systems. You can change the Ethernet settings on the fly, unlike Parallels, which requires a shutdown of the virtual machine. You can make changes to a bunch of other peripherals like sound, CD-ROM, hard disk, and USB controller. The last two aren't actually active yet. It says they'll be editable in future releases. The most useful buttons are the Ethernet, sound, and CD controls, which you can connect to automatically or toggle on from this window. So let's say the CD is being used over by the Mac side, but then you want the CD on the Windows side, you can just click the button and Windows takes control of the CD. Parallels has this feature in their latest release, but I like the detail and the view that Fusion gives you much better. On Windows, or on Parallels, you have to figure out that if you right-click on these little symbols on the bottom of the window in Parallels, you'll be able to disconnect devices or reconnect them in the VM. I just stumbled across it once. It's not that obvious. One of the things I've complained about in running Vista on Parallels is that it hammers the CPUs, and Fusion is no different. XP seems to run fine under Parallels, so I'll have to try that on Fusion as well. But anyway, running Vista, both menu meters on the Mac side and the CPU meter widget on Vista are both pegged whenever I try to do anything, like wiggle the mouse. Next on the Fusion menu bar is a full screen button, which doesn't tell you how to toggle back before it goes into it. Parallels does tell you every time, which you can toggle off as an alert if you like, but I keep it on because I keep forgetting how to get back to my OS X window. Another thing is when I went into full screen mode in Fusion, it did not go to full screen, but it put Vista on screen with black borders around it, not making it fill the screen, but rather keeping it at the desktop resolution that had been set in Vista. I guess if I went into Vista and did the desktop background thing, I could change the resolution to full screen, but in Parallels, it does a full screen automatically, and you can just drag the corner of the Parallels window and it automatically changes the size of the window in the guest operating system. The next six buttons across the top are very intriguing. Each one is a toggle, so if you click on them, they get a green bubble next to them, or the bubble disappears. The six buttons are CD, Ethernet, Sound Adapter, Apple IR Receiver, Apple Bluetooth Adapter, and Apple Built-in Eyesight. The last of these is the most intriguing to me because I'd love to be able to use a video camera in Windows, which you still can't do in Parallels. I tried to toggle on the Eyesight and I was given an interesting pop-up window. It says that I need to install Apple's Bootcamp driver. This makes so much sense to me. I actually tried to hack Parallels to use the bootcamp drivers, but I never got it to work. Obviously, since you can use your eyesight in bootcamp, if you could smash those drivers into the virtual machine, then maybe you could use them. Maybe I should back up just a teeny bit here and explain what bootcamp has to do with the story. Bootcamp is the technology that Apple developed that lets you run Windows on a Mac, but in that one you have to reboot out of OS X to get to Windows, so they don't run in parallel. Since Apple wrote it, they were able to create a set of drivers for the Mac hardware components that would work under Windows, and those are called the bootcamp drivers. Parallels, on the other hand, does not have access to these drivers, and so had to kind of work up their own for those components they could figure out. Most things work pretty well, but you certainly can't get to the eyesight, and you can't do anything under USB 2.0. The only downside to this bootcamp driver issue was that it required me to do some reading, as I don't see a button anywhere that says, Install Bootcamp Drivers. Well, off to the help files, which are web-based, but are actually stored locally in the VMware Fusion package, which took forever to open up, which was really odd. I don't know, I think it had to uncompress it or something or install it. I'm talking like 2 minutes to open it in the browser. Here's the really poopy part. The darn documentation has nothing about bootcamp. How lame. See why I hate to read documentation? It never helps. All right, how about if I just put the bootcamp driver disk into the CD-ROM and see if I can see it from Vista and run the installer? Well, sure enough, I was able to see the install Macintosh drivers for Windows XP icon inside the CD. Makes me happy that I'm probably going to mess up everything by using XP drivers in Vista. Isn't that great? Well, I started up the driver CD, but then I went to wash a couple of cars, and evidently I left Vista waiting for me to click Start, which was a very bad idea. It ran both CPUs at 100% for about an hour and a half. I came back to a very toasty MacBook Pro. Oh well, running the bootcamp drivers failed the first time, but I suspected that the CD-ROM might have fallen asleep, so I tried it again. Then again, it could have been because I'm using XP drivers under beta Vista under a beta virtual machine. What do you think? Well, in any case, running a second time didn't work either. When I get the energy for it, I'll head on over to the VMware site and see if there's any advice about this. I'll also load up XP on it soon, and maybe the drivers will work there. That was a more exhaustive review of Fusion than I'd planned, but I learned a lot more about the product that way. I gotta tell you, that's one of the coolest things about doing this podcast and doing the reviews. It forces me to really get to know a product, so I get a great benefit out of doing this too. Well, it looks like that's going to wrap it up for this week's installment of the NoSilicast. Let me know what you think about this week's reviews by dropping me a line at allison@podfeet.com, or if you favor recording your own voice like listener Steve, you can send it on over to nosilicast@gmail.com. Check out the forums too at podfeet.com/forums and get into some discussions there. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.